Side 2. For some time past, Mary's grave blue eyes had been fixed upon him.
"What have you been writing lately?" she asked.
It would be nice to have a little literary conversation.
"Oh, verse and prose," said Dennis.
"Just verse and prose."
"Prose?" Mr. Scogan pounced alarmingly on the word. "You've been writing prose?"
"Yes."
"Not a novel?"
"Yes."
"My poor Dennis," exclaimed Mr. Scogan. "What about?"
Dennis felt rather uncomfortable.
"Oh, about the usual things, you know."
"Of course," Mr. Scogan groaned. "I'll describe the plot for you. Little Percy, the hero, was never good at games, but he was always clever. He passes through the usual public school and the usual university and comes to London, where he lives among the artists. He is bowed down with melancholy thought. He carries the whole weight of the universe upon his shoulders. He writes a novel of dazzling brilliance. He dabbles delicately in amour and disappears at the end of the book into the luminous future."
Dennis blushed scarlet. Mr. Scogan had described the plan of his novel with an accuracy that was appalling. He made an effort to laugh.
"You're entirely wrong," he said. "My novel is not in the least like that."
It was a heroic lie. Luckily, he reflected, only two chapters were written. He would tear them up that very evening when he unpacked. Mr. Scogan paid no attention to his denial, but went on.
"Why will you young men continue to write about things that are so entirely uninteresting as the mentality of adolescents and artists? Professional anthropologists might find it interesting to turn sometimes from the beliefs of the black fellow to the philosophical preoccupations of the undergraduate, but you can't expect an ordinary adult man like myself to be much moved by the story of his spiritual troubles. And after all, even in England, even in Germany and Russia, there are more adults than adolescents. As for the artist, he is preoccupied with problems that are so utterly unlike those of the ordinary adult man. Problems of pure aesthetics, which don't so much as present themselves to people like myself. That a description of his mental processes is as boring to the ordinary reader as a piece of pure mathematics. A serious book about artists, regarded as artists, is unreadable. And a book about artists regarded as lovers, husbands, dipsomaniacs, heroes and the like is really not worth writing again. Jean-Christophe is the stock artist of literature, just as Professor Radium of Comic Cuts is its stock man of science."
"Oh, I'm sorry to hear I'm as uninteresting as all that," said Gombauld.
"Not at all, my dear Gombauld," Mr. Scogan hastened to explain. "As a lover or a dipsomaniac, I've no doubt of your being a most fascinating specimen. But as a combiner of forms, you must honestly admit it. You're a bore."
"I entirely disagree with you," exclaimed Mary.
She was somehow always out of breath when she talked, and her speech was punctuated by little gasps.
"I've known a great many artists, and I've always found their mentality very interesting, especially in Paris. Chuplitsky, for example. I saw a great deal of Chuplitsky in Paris this spring."
"Ah, but then you're an exception, Mary. You're an exception," said Mr. Scogan. "You are a femme supérieure."
A flush of pleasure turned Mary's face into a harvest moon. Chapter 4. Dennis woke up next morning to find the sun shining, the sky serene. He decided to wear white flannel trousers and a black jacket, with a silk shirt and his new peach-coloured tie. And what shoes? White was the obvious choice, but there was something rather pleasing about the notion of black patent leather. He lay in bed for several minutes considering the problem. Before he went down, patent leather was his final choice. He looked at himself critically in the glass. His hair might have been more golden, he reflected. As it was, its yellowness had the hint of a greenish tinge in it. But his forehead was good. His forehead made up in height what his chin lacked in prominence. His nose might have been longer, but it would pass. His eyes might have been blue and not green, but his coat was very well cut, and, discreetly padded, made him seem robuster than he actually was. His legs, in their white casing, were long and elegant. Satisfied, he descended the stairs. Most of the party had already finished their breakfast. He found himself alone with Jenny. "I hope you slept well," he said.
"Yes, isn't it lovely?" Jenny replied, giving two rapid little nods. "But we had such awful thunderstorms last week."
"Parallel straight lines," Dennis reflected, "meet only at infinity." He might talk forever of Care Charm asleep and she of meteorology till the end of time. Did one ever establish contact with anyone? We are all parallel straight lines. Jenny was only a little more parallel than most.
"They are very alarming, these thunderstorms," he said, helping himself to porridge. "Don't you think so? Or are you above being frightened?"
"No, I always go to bed in a storm. One is so much safer lying down."
"Why?"
"Because," said Jenny, making a descriptive gesture, "because lightning goes downwards and not flat ways. When you're lying down, you're out of the current."
"That's very ingenious."
"It's true."
There was a silence. Dennis finished his porridge and helped himself to bacon. For lack of anything better to say, and because Mr. Scogan's absurd phrase was for some reason running in his head, he turned to Jenny and asked,
"Do you consider yourself a femme supérieure?"
He had to repeat the question several times before Jenny got the hang of it.
"No,"
she said rather indignantly when at last she heard what Dennis was saying.
"Certainly not. Has anyone been suggesting that I am?"
"No," said Dennis. "Mr. Scogan told Mary she was one."
"Did he?"
Jenny lowered her voice. "Shall I tell you what I think of that man? I think he's slightly sinister." Having made this pronouncement, she entered the ivory tower of her deafness and closed the door. Dennis could not induce her to say anything more, could not induce her even to listen. She just smiled at him, smiled, and occasionally nodded. Dennis went out onto the terrace to smoke his after-breakfast pipe and to read his morning paper. An hour later, when Anne came down, she found him still reading. By this time he'd got to the court circular and the forthcoming weddings. He got up to meet her as she approached, a hammer dryad in white muslin, across the grass.
"Why, Dennis," she exclaimed, "you look perfectly sweet in your white trousers."
Dennis was dreadfully taken aback. There was no possible retort.
"You speak as though I were a child in a new frock," he said, with a show of irritation.
"But that's how I feel about you, Dennis, dear."
"Then you oughtn't to."
"But I can't help it. I'm so much older than you."
"I like that," he said. 4 years older."
"And if you do look perfectly sweet in your white trousers, why shouldn't I say so? And why did you put them on if you didn't think you were going to look sweet in them?"
"Let's go into the garden," said Dennis.
He was put out. The conversation had taken such a preposterous and unexpected turn. He had planned a very different opening, in which he was to lead off with, "You look adorable this morning," or something of the kind, and she was to answer, "Do I?" And then there was to be a pregnant silence. And now she had got in first with the trousers. It was provoking. His pride was hurt. That part of the garden that slopes down from the foot of the terrace to the pool had a beauty which did not depend on colour so much as on forms. It was as beautiful by moonlight as in the sun. The silver of water, the dark shapes of yew and ilex trees remained, at all hours and seasons, the dominant features of the scene. It was a landscape in black and white. For colour, there was the flower garden. It lay to one side of the pool, separated from it by a huge Babylonian wall of yews. You passed through a tunnel in the hedge, you opened a wicket in the wall, and you found yourself, startlingly and suddenly, in the world of colour. The July borders blazed and flared under the sun. Within its high brick walls, the garden was like a great tank of warmth and perfume and colour. Dennis held open the little iron gate for his companion. "It's like passing from a cloister into an oriental palace," he said, and took a deep breath of the warm, flower-scented air. "In fragrant volleys, they let fly..." How does it go? "Well shot, ye firemen, oh how sweet, and round your equal fires do meet, whose shrill report no ear can tell, but echoes to the eye and smell." "You have a bad habit of quoting," said Anne. "As I never know the context or author, I find it humiliating." Dennis apologized. "It's the fault of one's education. Things somehow seem more real and vivid when one can apply somebody else's ready-made phrase about them. And then there are lots of lovely names and words. Monophysite, iamblicus, pomponazzi. You bring them out triumphantly, and you feel you've clinched the argument with the mere magical sound of them. That's what comes of the higher education." "You may regret your education," said Anne. "I'm ashamed of my lack of it. Look at those sunflowers, aren't they magnificent? Dark faces and golden crowns. They're kings in Ethiopia. And I like the way the tits cling to the flowers and pick out the seeds, while the other loutish birds, grubbing dirtily for their food, look up in envy from the ground. Do they look up in envy?" "That's the literary touch, I'm afraid. Education again. It always comes back to that." He was silent. Anne had sat down on a bench that stood in the shade of an old apple tree. "I'm listening," she said. He did not sit down, but walked backwards and forwards in front of the bench, gesticulating a little as he talked. "Books," he said, "books. One reads so many, and one sees so few people, and so little of the world. Great, thick books about the universe and the mind and ethics. You've no idea how many there are. I must have read 20 or 30 tons of them in the last 5 years. 20 tons of ratiocination. Waited with that, one's pushed out into the world." He went on walking up and down. His voice rose, fell, was silent a moment, and then talked on. He moved his hands. Sometimes he waved his arms. Anne looked and listened quietly, as though she were at a lecture. He was a nice boy, and today he looked charming. Charming. "One entered the world," Dennis pursued, "having ready-made ideas about everything. One had a philosophy, and tried to make life fit into it. One should have lived first, and then made one's philosophy to fit life. Life, facts, things were horribly complicated. Ideas, even the most difficult of them, deceptively simple. In the world of ideas, everything was clear. In life, all was obscure, embroiled. Was it surprising that one was miserable, horribly unhappy?" Dennis came to a halt in front of the bench, and as he asked this last question, he stretched out his arms and stood for an instant in an attitude of crucifixion, and then let them fall again to his sides. "My poor Dennis." Anne was touched. He really was too pathetic as he stood there in front of her in his white flannel trousers. "But does one suffer about these things? It seems very extraordinary." "You're like Scogan," cried Dennis bitterly. "You regard me as a specimen for an anthropologist. Well, I suppose I am." "No, no," she protested, and drew in her skirt with a gesture that indicated that he was to sit down beside her. He sat down. "Why can't you just take things for granted, and as they come?" she asked. "It's so much simpler." "Of course it is," said Dennis, "but it's a lesson to be learnt gradually. There are 20 tons of ratiocination to be got rid of first." "I've always taken things as they come," said Anne. "It seems so obvious. One enjoys the pleasant things, avoids the nasty ones. There's nothing more to be said."
"Nothing for you. But then you were born a pagan. I am trying laboriously to make myself one. I can take nothing for granted. I can enjoy nothing as it comes along. Beauty, pleasure, art, women. I have to invent an excuse, a justification for everything that's delightful. Otherwise I can't enjoy it with an easy conscience. I make up a little story about beauty and pretend that it has something to do with truth and goodness. I have to say that art is the process by which one reconstructs the divine reality out of chaos. Pleasure is one of the mystical roads to union with the infinite, the ecstasies of drinking, dancing, lovemaking. As for women, I am perpetually assuring myself that they're the broad highway to divinity.
and to think that I'm only just beginning to see through the silliness of the whole thing. It's incredible to me that anyone should have escaped these horrors."
"It's still more incredible to me," said Anne, "that anyone should have been a victim to them. I should like to see myself believing that men are the highway to divinity." The amused malice of her smile planted two little folds on either side of her mouth, and through their half-closed lids her eyes shone with laughter. "What you need, Dennis, is a nice plump young wife, a fixed income, and a little congenial but regular work."
"What I need is you."
That was what he ought to have retorted. That was what he wanted passionately to say. He could not say it. His desire fought against his shyness.
"What I need is you."
Mentally he shouted the words, but not a sound issued from his lips. He looked at her despairingly. Couldn't she see what was going on inside him? Couldn't she understand?
"What I need is you."
He would say it. He would. He would.
"I think I shall go and bathe," said Anne. "It's so hot."
The opportunity had passed. Chapter 5. Mr. Wimbush had taken them to see the sights of the home farm, and now they were standing, all six of them, Henry Wimbush, Mr. Scogan, Dennis, Gombauld, Anne, and Mary, by the low wall of the piggery, looking into one of the sties. "This is a good sow," said Henry Wimbush. "She had a litter of 14.
14?
Mary echoed incredulously. She turned astonished blue eyes towards Mr. Wimbush and then let them fall onto the seething mass of élan vital that fermented in the sty. An immense sow reposed on her side in the middle of the pen. Her round black belly, fringed with a double line of dugs, presented itself to the assault of an army of small, brownish-black swine. With a frantic greed, they tugged at their mother's flank. The old sow stirred sometimes uneasily or uttered a little grunt of pain. One small pig, the runt, the weakling of the litter, had been unable to secure a place at the banquet. Squealing shrilly, he ran backwards and forwards, trying to push in amongst his stronger brothers, or even to climb over their tight little black backs towards the maternal reservoir.
"There are 14, said Mary. "You're quite right. I counted. It's extraordinary."
"The sow next door," Mr. Wimbush went on, "has done very badly. She only had 5 in her litter. I shall give her another chance. If she does no better next time, I shall fat her up and kill her. There's the boar," he pointed towards a father sty. "Fine old beast, isn't he? But he's getting past his prime. He'll have to go too."
"How cruel,"
Anne exclaimed.
"But how practical, how eminently realistic," said Mr. Scogan. "In this farm, we have a model of sound paternal government. Make them breed, make them work, and when they're past working or breeding or begetting, slaughter them."
"Farming seems to be mostly indecency and cruelty," said Anne.
With the ferrule of his walking stick, Dennis began to scratch the boar's long, bristly back. The animal moved a little so as to bring himself within easier range of the instrument that evoked in him such delicious sensations. Then he stood stock still, softly grunting his contentment. The mud of years flaked off his sides in a grey, powdery scurf.
"What a pleasure it is," said Dennis, "to do somebody a kindness. I believe I enjoy scratching this pig quite as much as he enjoys being scratched. If only one could always be kind with so little expense of trouble."
A gate slammed. There was a sound of heavy footsteps.
"Morning, Rowley," said Henry Wimbush.
"Morning, sir,"
old Rowley answered. He was the most venerable of the labourers on the farm, a tall, solid man, still unbent, with grey side whiskers and a steep, dignified profile. Grave, weighty in his manner, splendidly respectable, Rowley had the air of a great English statesman of the mid-19th century. He halted on the outskirts of the group, and for a moment they all looked at the pigs in a silence that was only broken by the sound of grunting or the squelch of a sharp hoof in the mire. Rowley turned at last, slowly and ponderously and nobly, as he did everything, and addressed himself to Henry Wimbush.
Look at them, sir,
he said, with a motion of his hand towards the wallowing swine.
Rightly is they called pigs.
Rightly indeed, Mr. Wimbush agreed.
I am abashed by that man, said Mr. Scogan, as old Rowley plodded off slowly and with dignity. What wisdom, what judgment, what a sense of values! Rightly are they called swine. Yes, and I wish I could, with as much justice, say rightly are we called men.
They walked on towards the cowsheds and the stables of the cart horses. Five white geese, taking the air this fine morning, even as they were doing, met them in the way. They hesitated, cackled, then, converting their lifted necks into rigid horizontal snakes, they rushed off in disorder, hissing horribly as they went. Red calves paddled in the dung and mud of a spacious yard. In another enclosure stood the bull, massive as a locomotive. He was a very calm bull, and his face wore an expression of melancholy stupidity. He gazed with reddish-brown eyes at his visitors, chewed thoughtfully at the tangible memories of an earlier meal, swallowed and regurgitated, chewed again. His tail lashed savagely from side to side. It seemed to have nothing to do with his impassive bulk. Between his short horns was a triangle of red curls, short and dense.
Splendid animal, said Henry Wimbush, pedigree stock, but he's getting a little old, like the boar.
Fat him up and slaughter him,
Mr. Scogan pronounced, with a delicate old maidish precision of utterance. Couldn't you give the animals a little holiday from producing children? Asked Anne. I'm sorry for the poor things. Mr. Wimbush shook his head.
Personally, he said, I rather like seeing 14 pigs grow where only one grew before. The spectacle of so much crude life is refreshing.
I'm glad to hear you say so, Gumbold broke in warmly. Lots of life. That's what we want. I like pollulation. Everything ought to increase and multiply as hard as it can.
Gumbold grew lyrical. Everybody ought to have children. Anne ought to have them. Mary ought to have them. Dozens and dozens. He emphasized his point by thumping with his walking stick on the bull's leather flanks. Mr. Scogan ought to pass on his intelligence to little Scogans, and Dennis to little Dennises. The bull turned his head to see what was happening, regarded the drumming stick for several seconds, then turned back again, satisfied, it seemed, that nothing was happening. Sterility was odious, unnatural, a sin against life.
Life, life, and still more life.
The ribs of the placid bull resounded. Standing with his back against the farmyard pump, a little apart, Dennis examined the group. Gumbold, passionate and vivacious, was its centre. The others stood round listening. Henry Wimbush, calm and polite beneath his grey bowler, Mary with parted lips and eyes that shone with the indignation of a convinced birth controller. Anne looked on through half-shut eyes, smiling. And beside her stood Mr. Scogan, bolt upright in an attitude of metallic rigidity that contrasted strangely with that fluid grace of hers, which even in stillness suggested a soft movement. Gumbold ceased talking, and Mary, flushed and outraged, opened her mouth to refute him. But she was too slow. Before she could utter a word, Mr. Scogan's fluty voice had pronounced the opening phrases of a discourse. There was no hope of getting so much as a word in edgeways. Mary had perforce to resign herself.
"Even your eloquence, my dear Gumbold," he was saying, "even your eloquence must prove inadequate to reconvert the world to a belief in the delights of mere multiplication. With the gramophone, the cinema, and the automatic pistol, the goddess of applied science has presented the world with another gift, more precious even than these, the means of dissociating love from propagation." Eros, for those who wish it, is now an entirely free god. His deplorable associations with Lucina may be broken at will. In the course of the next few centuries, who knows? The world may see a more complete severance. I look forward to it optimistically. Where the great Erasmus Darwin and Miss Anna Seward, Swan of Lichfield, experimented, and for all their scientific ardour, failed, our descendants will experiment and succeed. An impersonal generation will take the place of nature's hideous system. In vast state incubators, rows upon rows of gravid bottles will supply the world with the population it requires. The family system will disappear. Society, sapped at its very base, will have to find new foundations. And Eros, beautifully and irresponsibly free, will flit like a gay butterfly from flower to flower through a sunlit world.
It sounds lovely, said Anne.
The distant future always does.
Mary's china-blue eyes, more serious and more astonished than ever, were fixed on Mr. Scogan.
Bottles, she said. Do you really think so? Bottles?
Chapter 6. Mr. Barbecue Smith arrived in time for tea on Saturday afternoon. He was a short and corpulent man, with a very large head and no neck. In his earlier middle age, he had been distressed by this absence of neck, but was comforted by reading in Balzac's Louis Lambert that all the world's great men have been marked by the same peculiarity, and for a simple and obvious reason. Greatness is nothing more or less than the harmonious functioning of the faculties of the head and heart. The shorter the neck, the more closely these two organs approach one another. Argal, it was convincing. Mr. Barbecue Smith belonged to the old school of journalists. He sported a leonine head with a greyish-black mane of oddly unappetizing hair brushed back from a broad but low forehead. And somehow he always seemed slightly, ever so slightly, soiled. In younger days, he had gaily called himself a bohemian. He did so no longer. He was a teacher now, a kind of prophet. Some of his books of comfort and spiritual teaching were in their 120,000. Priscilla received him with every mark of esteem. He had never been to Crome before. She showed him round the house. Mr. Barbecue Smith was full of admiration. "So quaint, so old world," he kept repeating. He had a rich, rather unctuous voice. Priscilla praised his latest book.
"Splendid, I thought it was,"
she said in her large, jolly way.
"I'm happy to think you found it a comfort," said Mr. Barbecue Smith. "Oh, tremendously! And the bit about the lotus pool, I thought that was so beautiful." "I knew you would like that. It came to me, you know, from without."
He waved his hand to indicate the astral world. They went out into the garden for tea. Mr. Barbecue Smith was duly introduced.
"Mr. Stone is a writer, too," said Priscilla, as she introduced Dennis. "Indeed,"
Mr. Barbecue Smith smiled benignly, and looking up at Dennis with an expression of Olympian condescension.
"And what sort of things do you write?"
Dennis was furious, and to make matters worse, he felt himself blushing hotly. Had Priscilla no sense of proportion? She was putting them in the same category, Barbecue Smith and himself. They were both writers. They both used pen and ink. To Mr. Barbecue Smith's question, he answered,
"Oh, nothing much. Nothing,"
and looked away. "Mr. Stone is one of our younger poets." It was Anne's voice. He scowled at her, and she smiled back exasperatingly.
"Excellent, excellent,"
said Mr. Barbecue Smith, and he squeezed Dennis's arm encouragingly.
"The bard's is a noble calling."
End of side 2.